This is Tuesday, the 8th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming up, Kenyans head to the polls to select a president.
We expect change. We need new blood to come in.
We'll take you to Nairobi for the latest. Also ahead, the U.S. president's latest poll numbers are surprisingly low for many. We talk about it with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. And the UN has found what it calls widespread use of excessive force and torture by the Venezuelan government against protesters. It's all on today's International Edition. Let's start in Africa today, where today voters in Kenya have been deciding if their president, Uhuru Kenyatta, will continue to lead their country. Kenyatta is facing off against opposition leader Raila Odinga for the second time in 4 years in a vote that is projected to be tight. Maurice Aruma was one of those casting his vote.
We expect to pay for the change we need. If things have gone too high, life is very difficult. They keep on telling us so many things which are not in practice. So we expect change. We need new blood to come in and maybe get us on another direction, not the direction we have, the current direction we have.
Joining us from Nairobi via Skype is VOA Africa correspondent Jill Craig. Jill, any indication that voters like Mr. Aruna will get the change they're seeking?
Well, I think right now that's very much up in the air. The polls most recently have indicated that Mr. Odinga and also Mr. Kenyatta are very much neck and neck in the polls. As of about an hour ago, 293 polling stations out of 40,883 had reported. So I think at this point it's a bit too early to determine that. But I can say that many people, like the gentleman you just had on, share his view, as obviously the other side also have a very different view.
Well, let's go to the possibility or any reports of violence. As you know, the recent torture killing of a top election official, Chris Masondo, the former U.S. President Barack Obama, whose father was born in Kenya, issued a statement on Monday calling all Kenyans to reject violence and incitement. Has that plea been followed so far?
Yes, actually, on election day today, there have been no, to my knowledge, there have not been any reports of violence at the polls. There was an incident where one of the polling stations opened up between 3 and 5 hours late, I believe, and so people were getting very agitated, and reports are saying that the police did fire tear gas in that particular instance. But in terms of actual violence, no, today has been very, very peaceful, and that's pretty much what when I've talked to Kenyans this morning, they all say that they want these polls to be peaceful. Now we're just waiting, though, until the results are announced, and that could be the next time where we sort of have to wait and see if it will remain calm.
Any idea how long that might take?
The Constitution stipulates that the Electoral Commission has up to 7 days to release those results, so presumably they have until next Tuesday. However, the Electoral Commission has also indicated that they are going to try to get the results released by Friday the 11th, so this coming Friday, which would be much better, obviously, than Tuesday. So now we just sort of wait.
How closely watched has this vote been, especially, I guess, on a physical level, on an international level, international observers, election observers coming in?
Oh, yes. I would say that pretty much every electoral observation mission is here. Lots and lots of people are here for the Kenyan elections. It's one of the most watched elections on this continent. And I can tell you that here in Kenya, politics is pretty much in everyone's blood. So for the last year, there has been, you know, obviously more official campaigns that have been going on. And then some argue that actually the campaigning started after the last elections in 2013. So politics are very widely followed. Politicians are like celebrities in other parts of the world. So Kenyans can tell you exactly who is, the cabinet minister of this and the cabinet minister of that. So I can say that they have been very, very well followed. And so I think that also makes the stakes a bit higher when we're sort of waiting for the results to be announced.
If Odinga does win, what happens as far as policy is concerned in that country? Are there any, what differences might be expected?
That's a very good question. And I know that a lot of people sometimes get frustrated because they say that the manifestos between both the opposition and the ruling party are extremely similar. If you talk to the candidates, the main divide, I would say, is that President Kenyatta usually talks and touts his major infrastructure projects. So, for example, the standard gauge railway was recently inaugurated just several months ago. And so he has been touting all of his larger infrastructure, sort of big picture projects, where Mr. Odinga says, yeah, that's all well and good. That's nice to have better infrastructure. However, we've got people that don't have enough food and health care and education. So therefore, Mr. Odinga has taken the stance of sort of helping people with more daily needs. Those would be the two differences. In terms of what would actually happen if Mr. Odinga were elected, I think that pretty much remains to be seen.
All right. And I'm sure you've heard this already. South Africa, I'm catching you unprepared here probably, but the parliament speaker says 198 voted against no confidence motion in Zuma in South Africa, 177 vote for the motion, 9 of them abstained. Any reaction to that, or did we lose you already?
Well, I recently saw that myself. I've pretty much been wrapped up in the Kenyan elections today, so I'll probably take tomorrow to digest the South African information as well.
Fair enough. Sorry to catch you off guard on that. VOA Africa correspondent Jill Craig in Nairobi, thanks so much for being with us. VOA's International Edition continues. Donald Trump has been president of the United States for just over 200 days now. His term so far has been described in many ways, in both positive and negative terms. His use of Twitter, his many tweets seen by many as risky and dangerous, seen by him as a way to circumnavigate what he calls the fake media and reach his core base, has been under discussion. We welcome VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone to International Edition, and as we love to do that. Jim, some media outlets have come out with new polling numbers on the Trump presidency, numbers at least on the face value do not look kindly upon the president.
No, he's not in great political shape as we move towards 7 months in office. And in fact, by a lot of measurements, he's at a historical low for a new president. That being said, we know that he frequently likes to return to his base voters. Just last week, he was in West Virginia, got a rousing reception from thousands in West Virginia. So we know that the president relies on his political base and seems to have spent much of his presidency catering to that base and making very little effort to extend his support outward.
But do these numbers show that that core base is shrinking in any way?
There are some indications now that that base is a little bit shakier than it was. For example, one of the key things you look at in polls is, do you strongly approve or strongly disapprove of someone? And what we're seeing in terms of Republicans on the numbers of strongly approve of the president, they were well into the 70s and the 80s early on. One recent poll, I think it's CNN, has it down to only 59%. That shows the enthusiasm among his core supporters seems to be waning a bit. That may be in part because they haven't been able to get much of the legislative program through, most notably the health care reform effort.
Well, we are hearing reports all the time that there are parts of the Republican Party that are not very happy with their president. We're hearing about discord inside the White House. How much of that is true? Because it's all being denied by Trump and his tweets.
Well, certainly there's discord within the Republican Party. We see that playing out in Congress. That's why they were not able to agree in the Senate on a health care replacement bill for Obamacare. And here's the other thing to keep in mind, Ira. As you well know, charting the rise of Donald Trump through the primaries, much of the Republican establishment kept their distance from him. Some openly opposed him. Few embraced him. So there's this issue now where the Republican establishment and Trump, sort of a cohabitation agreement stemming from his inauguration, they see him as someone who can help get their agenda through. But we're seeing that go on the rocks a bit. And that becomes particularly important if you look to next year's congressional elections, where possibly the fate of control of both the House and Senate will be at stake. If the president's unpopular, if Republicans have little to point to about their achievements, that's going to raise the stakes for Democrats to do well in those elections.
Andrew Palcheski joins us with a look at social media. What are the social media masses having to say about all this?
Well, you talk about the poll numbers, and one of the poll numbers that I was struck by is that nearly 3/4 of Americans express concern about President Trump's Twitter use. They say that it's counterproductive. So that's one of the indications that he may be having some issues with his preferred medium of communication, which is Twitter and social media. He said in the past that's his way to reach out directly to people, and it seems to be working well to reach directly to his base. But for the broader American populace, who maybe he's trying to bring in and build on his coalition of supporters, it may not be working as well for him.
Jim, overall, what is this Twitter use doing as far as the public perception of the presidency is concerned? There's a report today that there was a report on Fox News giving out some information that's supposed to be top secret dealing with Korean missiles, and he retweeted it.
Yeah, he likes to lead with his gut feelings on Twitter. Now, part of this is he does not hold many news conferences. The ones he holds are very brief. He hasn't had a really full news conference in months. So the only way he's going to, A, get his message across to his followers is through Twitter. The other thing is, I think it's really a venting mechanism for him. As much as he's talking to his followers, he's also trying to express his frustrations, and there have been many. So it's seen as a platform. And I noticed that even when the new chief of staff came in, General Kelly, there wasn't any pronouncement that he was going to try to get the president weaned off of Twitter. I think they realize that's probably not going to happen.
Oh, boy. And that's not the only story. There are all kinds of stories. The ongoing Russia investigation, which he's trying to, you know, call a hoax and continually calling the news media the fake media.
Right. Now, one thing he does on Twitter is he continually recalibrates sort of what we're all paying attention to. That has been somewhat of an effective tool. I just wonder in the long run, if this goes on, if it's going to lose its impact, it's going to lose its potency. We'll see, because right now it is the main method of communicating with those who stay loyal to him and also venting at what he likes to say is the fake news media.
And creating a ever wider chasm between other people who don't like what he's doing
at
the same time.
But they obviously are much more focused on catering and shoring up that base of support. And as these latest polls show, they might be well to do that, because if he is starting to slip among his core supporters, his political position will weaken even further.
Jim Malone, VOA's national correspondent. Andrew Palcheski is still here. What else are people talking about?
Well, I want to go back to the top of the show, what you were talking about with the Kenyan elections. And we saw a couple of photos going up on social media. President Kenyatta tweeting a photo of him voting, saying that he was performing his civic duty. His rival, Raila Odinga, tweeting that he went and voted with his wife, Ida. The one thing that I'm struck by as we look at all of these different photos, from the candidates putting out these images to people going and voting and putting up pictures of taking their 98, 99, 100-year-old parents to go vote, is how similar this is to elections we've seen around the world. And here in the U.S., the circumstances may be different, the localities may be different, but we're seeing social media used in very similar ways to draw out support, to rally the vote, to show these little vignettes of people going out and voting after however many years of being alive. So even though this is halfway around the world from us here in the United States, seeing a lot of similarities linked through social media.
Andrew Palcheski, how to get in touch with you?
You can find me on Twitter at APAL, APAL.
This is International Edition. Among the top stories, Kenyans queued in large numbers to vote today in an electoral showdown between the country's foremost political dynasties. President Trump commended the international community Tuesday for confronting North Korea over its nuclear weapons development. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made a short visit to Thailand for talks on trade and regional security matters before he moved on to Malaysia. President Trump's administration is reviewing a climate change report prepared by 13 federal agencies that's reached conclusions that conflict with administration perspectives. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. Astronomers normally prefer to conduct their observations during the deepest dark hours of the night. But Ned Moulter, a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, found something rather remarkable as he observed Neptune during twilight hours at the W.M. Keck Observatory on Mauna Kea, Hawaii. Moulter spotted a gigantic storm system nearly the size of Earth raging on the planet's equator. The discovery seems to have left other astronomers scratching their heads, since no one has ever seen anything like it in that specific region of Neptune. Bright storm clouds such as those found by Moulter have been spotted occasionally in the past, but they were located closer to the planet's polar regions. Scientists suspect the huge cloud system was caused by a large, high-pressure, dark vortex system deep within Neptune's atmosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm Ira Melvin in Washington, and this is International Edition from VOA. The United Nations Human Rights Office says it has unearthed widespread and systemic use of excessive force, arbitrary detention, and other rights violations against demonstrators and detainees in Venezuela. At a news conference in Geneva today, spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani said that preliminary findings suggest there are no signs that the situation was improving. The team's analysis found security forces allegedly responsible for at least 46 deaths, and pro-government armed groups were allegedly responsible for 27 among 124 deaths being investigated in connection with demonstrations against President Nicolas Maduro's government.
Since the wave of demonstrations began in April, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, says that there has been a clear pattern of excessive force used against protesters. Several thousand people have been arbitrarily detained, many reportedly subjected to ill treatment and even torture, while several hundred have been brought before military rather than civilian courts. These patterns show no signs of abating.
The Rights Office team said that violations included house raids, torture, and ill treatment of those detained in connection with the protest. A full report on the team's findings is expected later on this month.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
President Donald Trump's administration is reviewing a climate change report prepared by 13 federal agencies that has reached conclusions that conflict with administration perspectives. The report found human activity extremely likely the cause of more than half of the Earth's temperature increase since 1951. That is a position that is at odds with the administration's belief that the cause of global warming is uncertain. The report said human impact caused an increase in the global temperatures of 0.6 degrees Celsius to 0.7 degrees Celsius between 1951 and 2010, and that heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions lead the way as the primary contributor. The Trump administration received a copy of the most recent draft of the report several weeks ago, according to senior administration officials. It is unclear if the administration, which announced in June it would withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, will approve the report. The study will be included in the National Climate Assessment, which is mandated by Congress every 4 years. An earthquake measuring 6.5 in magnitude struck China's remote and mountainous southwestern province of Sichuan Tuesday, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, killing at least five people and trapping 100 tourists at a popular scenic spot. The quake hit a sparsely populated area 200 kilometers west-northwest of the city of Guangguan at the depth of 10 kilometers. It had earlier put the quake at a magnitude 6.6 with a depth of 32 kilometers. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram allow us to share aspects of our lives with our friends, family, and the world. But what we are sharing say about our state of mind? Kevin Enix has more.
We live in the age of sharing. Events, great and small, moments, big and little, become chapters in the book of our online lives. It turns out some of the information you're sharing may be saying more about you than you think, says Chris Danforth via Skype.
Yeah, I think that, with so much more of our life happening on the internet these days and the ubiquity of mobile phones in our lives, there's just a lot more that we're revealing about our behavior maybe than we're even aware of.
The mathematician and his colleague Peter Dodds created some machine learning tools to analyze people's Instagram posts.
We found out basically that people who had been diagnosed with depression, their pictures tended to be darker and bluer and grayer. If they chose to use a filter, it tended to be the black and white filter Inkwell. That's the one they chose more often than any others.
You can see the differences in some of the images Danforth analyzed. Gray or blue filters versus the vibrant colors of the originals just look, well, depressing.
It's not new news that people who are depressed see the world in darker colors, spend less time in social groups, but being able to infer this from social media, that was something new.
Danforth says it could lead the way to an app that alerts your doctor when you're in emotional trouble.
Maybe 5 to 10 years from now, if studies like the one we've done here, they bear fruit in larger groups, and they're reproduced, you could imagine installing an app, downloading an app that you consent to having your data shared with your physician so they can know when it's time to see you sooner.
Danforth points out there are also huge privacy concerns involved and that more research is needed to figure out how well machines can diagnose a human's state of mind. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
That wraps it up for us. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Homemade bombs, known as improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, are used by terrorists not only to attack opposition military forces, but also increasingly to harm civilian populations. As a world leader in clearing explosive hazards that threaten civilians, the United States is taking action to tackle these deadly devices in Iraq, Syria, Colombia, Afghanistan, and elsewhere around the world. According to the Landmine Monitor, an annual report by a non-governmental organization, person-activated IEDs and improvised landmines caused 1,075 casualties in 2014 and 1,331 casualties in 2015. IEDs are a particular threat to both military personnel and civilians as they enter areas previously occupied by terrorists. For example, during the final months of the battle for Mosul, ISIS sowed the city streets with IEDs to prevent civilians from leaving. Later, as they retreated from the city, the terrorists set thousands of IEDs around critical infrastructure like power and water utilities, schools, and hospitals. Non-state armed groups such as ISIS and the Taliban often use IEDs to destabilize peace operations and terrorize civilian populations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, writes Stephanie Pico, a public diplomacy officer at the U.S. Department of State. ISIS also has deliberately placed IEDs before retreating from an area with the intent of prolonging insecurity, inflicting additional casualties on communities struggling to recover, and delaying economic redevelopment in liberated communities long after direct ISIS-instigated hostilities in those areas cease. The United States is the world leader in conventional weapons destruction, including humanitarian demining, having invested over $2.8 billion in projects in more than 100 countries since 1993. In addition to humanitarian demining, the United States' counter-IED efforts work to disrupt networks that use IEDs and train the forces fighting those networks to identify IEDs and protect against them. Counter-IED differs from humanitarian demining in that it focuses on deterring, detecting, and preventing IED employment before threats become imminent, writes Stephanie Pico. Working with our allies in the international community, she writes, the United States will continue to develop strategies to address the IED threat to prevent IED users from carrying out their nefarious plans and achieve peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.